Okay. Hi, I'm Michael, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Michael.
I'm going to try to forgive Stephanie for asking me to do this today, because I so didn't want to. But here we are. It's funny, I did a lead share here a year and a half ago, and then so I was really ambivalent about being back so soon on the circuit. And so I called a fellow of mine and I said, I don't know, yesterday I committed, but I want to get out of it and everything. And then he listens to me go on and on about this, and then he's quiet and he says, yeah, you're not so special. Nobody's going to remember what you said a year and a half ago. So here we are. 2 weeks ago, I ended up in the emergency room. I thought I was having a heart attack, and it was in the middle of the night. I decided I was going to walk it off, and of course it didn't work. And so I was like, well, we can either like roll the dice and have somebody find us in this apartment, or we can go get checked out. So I go to Cedars-Sinai, and I don't know if you've been in the ER lately. It's really a catastrophe. It's like an insane asylum. People are walking around. People are screaming. It's not a pleasant experience. And, you know, I got all checked out and I was, you know, it wasn't a heart attack. I have other issues going, but it's all solvable, I think. At least I hope. But the point is that, you know, when you think you're having a heart attack, you go in, they take you in right away because you get to the front of the line because they think you're about to collapse. Then when they figure out you're not going to die, then you get bumped to the back of the line. And then you get to sit with everybody else. So there's 40 people in this enormous waiting room. And it's 3 a.m. And I'm waiting for the other test results and the doctor, blah, blah, blah. And as I'm sitting there, 2 things occur to me. One is, okay, well, I'm grateful we're not having a heart attack. But the other was, how did I end up here? And by here, I mean, how did I end up in a waiting room, in an emergency room, at 3 a.m, alone? Because I don't have that person. I don't have the person who I can wake up and say, I'm in trouble. Take me. Wait with me. Cut through the red tape with me. Go bother the nurse for me. Go get me water. When I get the flu, I get dressed and get in the car and drive to the CVS. I have been alone almost my entire adult life, despite numerous attempts not to be. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because it just has dawned on me in doing the work that my disease was all about trying to find love. And we don't talk about love a lot in OA, and I think we should. And I think we don't because it's inherently uncomfortable. And it's hard. And it's humbling when you don't have it, when you've been unsuccessful at it. And I have been objectively unsuccessful. And I think so much of that is the fact that I just didn't love myself for most of my life. And if you don't love yourself, it's very hard for other people to love you. Although I will tell you, I come into these rooms and I hear lead shares all the time. And people say, well, then I got married. And I'm like, oh, my God. How did you manage it? All my life, I have felt like there was a secret that everybody had that I didn't have. Everybody knew how to do it, and I didn't. Now, look, part of this was the gay thing. You know what I mean? Gay people are raised, we're the only ones raised as something else. And we have to sort of on our own figure out that we're on the wrong side of the street and cross over. And depending upon your situation and where you grew up and your family and everything, that can take a little time or a long time. I was on the long time, you know, sort of track. Despite the fact that at age 7, the first album I ever bought was Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves by Snow. How did my family not turn to me and say, oh, we have something to tell you? Clueless. But I think, and I've shared this before, you know, I was the youngest of 4. I grew up in Philadelphia. My father worked in a garage. My mother was a housewife. And because I was, there was a big gap between me and my other 3 brothers. They were sort of bunched together. I spent an inordinate amount of time alone growing up. I was creative and sensitive and artistic, and I occupied myself. And to me, my sort of role was to keep out of everybody's way and to be the good son. So I was the good son. My parents used to go out to dinner. My brothers would be out doing their thing, and then I would clean the house. So that when they came home, it looked like Martha Stewart had been visiting. And, I mean, who does that? But who does that is a little boy who wants approval, a little boy who wants to be loved, a little boy who feels like he has to earn it. It's not going to be given. You have to earn your place here. You have to earn the love. And when you grow up like that, if that's your norm, then that transfers into everything. Everything has to be earned. Now, on the plus side, what happens is you get really good grades. You're the good kid. You join the Boy Scouts. You do all of those. I did all of those. Scout of the Year. Like, I did all of it. You know what I mean? On the flip side, though, you carry with you this belief that says, if I don't have to earn this, I don't trust it. So when people come into your life who freely give love and who are available to you emotionally, you are inherently suspicious because you think, this doesn't feel right to me. This feels icky. Like, what's wrong with you? And you push them away. The food came when I was an adolescent. My mother's sisters, my aunts, we used to call them the aunts. They were like this, like the Beatles. They were like this group. Sort of ran the whole show. I always say we were the Kennedys without the money. And they would sit at my mother's dining room table. She was the pearl mace of the group. And they would sit at the dining room table. And I would come home from school. And my mother was glad to shove a huge trough of soda and cupcakes at me and let me watch reruns of the Brady Bunch every day so that she could sit at the dining room table and have a beer with her sisters. That was the dynamic. So, I mean, that was a great gig for me. I mean, awesome. Except, of course, I got very large very fast. And then, of course, you get shamed. Well, why are you so fat? Well, okay. I then found restricting as a teenager, got really skinny, and that was sort of the train pulling out of the station. There was fat years and thin years and fat years and thin years. And, you know, that's sort of like how it went. I found love in that I found three successive women, believe it or not, who were clingy, and I was really good. Like, I went to six proms, you know what I mean? Because I was like, I dressed well, I was articulate, I was thoughtful, I bought nice flowers, like, yeah. So I was the guy every mother wanted her daughter to marry. And like, yeah, you might be gay, but like, oh, well, what? Nobody's going to. And so when I got into my first love relationships with women, I deliberately picked women who were clingy because I thought, well, I can control this. You know what I mean? Like, I can hide in this because you're not going to leave me because you need me more than I need you. Broke their hearts, each of them. And when I had to go make my amends, boy, that was not pretty. I couldn't find two of them. I'm still looking for them. But the other one, whew, was not good. But I did it. But we digress. When I finally came out, I thought, okay, this is going to be good. The food's going to be, I'm not going to be turning to food. Because I knew I had an unhealthy relationship with food. You know, I knew that I had an unhealthy relationship with my body. I knew that I had an issue. But I just thought, you know what? It's not a big deal. Lots of people yo-yo diet, right? Lots of people have struggle with their weight up and down. Like, okay. It's fine. But if I'm now that I'm on the right path, you know, then it'll all work out. There was always some magical solution outside of me that was going to fix it. There was some person, there was some social group, there was a trip. I move. My God, that I was the guy who, like, I'm going to move and then that will solve everything. I moved from Philadelphia to Atlantic City, to Northern New Jersey, to Boston, to New York, and then back to Philly. Like a big East Coast loop. Every new apartment was the new beginning, right? Except I'm carrying the old luggage, which is me. I'm along for the ride. Never occurs to me that this is a problem. And of course, coming out didn't solve it because I was still broken. I was still shattered inside, and it didn't matter. And so what I did then was I did two things. Back to the food in a big way. And I became really successful in my career because I thought, well, if we can't figure out the love thing, no one will love us, then we can at least be successful and we'll have that card to play with people. When you stand at cocktail parties, what's the first thing people say? They say, well, what do you do? And I thought, well, I'm going to have a really good answer. And I did have a really good answer. I went to work as a magazine writer and editor. And I've worked at a bunch of magazines that you've all heard of, and they were very fancy, and I lived a very sort of fancy life, especially my Sex and the City years in New York. Bought a lot of shoes, I did. Because they always fit, right? No matter how big you get, shoes are going to fit. For sure. And so I had this amazing career, and still the emptiness inside was stunning. Like, I just couldn't, I have to tell you, there was so much disbelief. I would look in the mirror and I'd be like, why aren't we happy? I don't get it. And I would tick off all, like, you have all of this. And yes, you're fat today, but like, you won't be fat tomorrow. And there's always another diet to start. And there was always another trainer to hire. And there was always another Zumba class to go to. And yes, don't judge. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Because I couldn't fill it. I couldn't fill the hole that had opened up. The hole that had gotten bigger and bigger and bigger since I was a child. And you try to fill it with food. You know, you try to bake your way through it. I certainly did. But it doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't work. And so my gay relationships didn't work either because I'm the one who's the clingy one. I'm the one on the other side. I'm the one who feels intimidated. I'm the one who feels like I'm not good enough. And so the tables have flipped. I now know how those women felt, and it doesn't feel good at all. And so I have only one default when that happens, which is I've got to go to the food. It's the only thing that's going to say yes when life says no. So I sat in my various glamorous apartments and ate. The thing about working in publishing, if any of you have seen The Devil Wears Prada, I was the smart fat girl, you know, that Miranda Priestly hired. And you cannot be fat. Like, it's just not allowed. And I ended up, it's a long story, but I ended up working in a bunch of fashion and beauty magazines. And it's really that, I remember my mother saw that movie and she was like, oh, it was ridiculous. Who would believe that? I was like, where do you think I work? Yeah. That's where I work. So again, the restricting comes in. It all is just a nightmare. It's just a nightmare because at the core of it, through all of the noise and all of the Prada shoes and all of it, is the basic fact of, I don't love myself, no one will love me back, I'm bereft, I am empty inside. And I am getting more and more empty every single day. And what is going to happen when I'm completely empty? It was frightening. Because I could see it. I've never tried to take my own life, but I have certainly sat and thought, wow, it'd be awesome not to be here. It would be terrific if I could get hit by a bus. I'm not going to jump out in front of the bus. But if God is good, he'll put a bus in my path. That would be terrific. I'll have a great memorial service. Hopefully my sister-in-law will use the flattering picture. These are thoughts I had all the time. All the time. And somehow thought, well, this is normal. It's not normal. It's not normal. August of 2020, the pandemic, you know, whatever. By then, like, I'm really large and really just, I'm back in Philly and, you know, we're all locked inside, which is like, you know, the gift that keeps on giving to our disease, right? You have to be locked inside and make your own food. Oh, great. So it's me and Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines and Mrs. Fields and, like, that's who's living with me. Those are my roommates. Pillsbury Doughboy, too. Never the Green Giant. And I reached that day we all reach, right? That lays us here, which is like the I've had it day. And I've told this story before where my father had died in 2013 and, you know, he had a great second act. He was an alcoholic and, was not really involved meaningfully in my life at all growing up. But when he got sober, when I was about 25, he became another person. We got really close. I mean, he worked his 12 steps. Like, he was a poster boy for this program. We were really, really close, and I'm so grateful for all that. And I'm so sorry that he didn't get to see me in recovery. I think that would have been amazing. But I talked to him one night on my bedroom floor, and I was down to one outfit. I mean, literally, that fit. Like, I didn't have anything left. I was wearing, like, bed sheets. Like, it was horrible. And I said, I just can't be here anymore. I just really can't be here anymore. Can you get me where you are? I just want to be where you are. Can you get me there? Can you do that? And I heard him say, go to bed. It's one of the reasons I believe in two-way prayer a lot, because I do a lot of two-way prayer and I never get a message that I want back. That's how I know it's legit. People say, how do you know it's legit? I'm like, because it's never what I want to hear. It's always something I don't want to do that I get messaged back. And I did that, and I didn't want to go to bed. I wanted to not be there. So I went to bed the next day. I logged on to an OA meeting on Zoom, and with a bunch of women named Joan and Marge, and I started, you know, and I didn't think it would work. I mean, I don't know about all of you, but, like, I have to tell you, I was grumpy. I was fat and grumpy, and I just thought, well, we have nothing to lose, but I didn't think I had anything to gain. I just thought, this won't work, but, like, at least I'll say I did it. You know what I mean? It'll be performative. So I went on. And it wasn't great, to tell you the truth, that first meeting, because I wasn't in the right mindset. Well, who is, right? I mean, you're at the bottom of the well. Like, you're like, you've had it. But I the one message they kept saying that you hear all the time is you got to keep coming back, right? Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you don't want to be here. It doesn't matter if, like, we don't want to be in this club. Who wants to be in this club? But, like, you're in it. Come back. And eventually this will happen for you. So I came back the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. And then I started to go to other meetings, and I started to meet other people. And then I found a sponsor. I found a guy who was 30 years younger than me, but he had what I wanted. I thought, no, I want to be you. I want... And it wasn't like his life was perfect or anything like that. It's funny. I picked a guy who did not have all the trappings that I was sort of after in my head. He was single, for one thing. But he had a zen about him. He had a self-love about him that radiated off him. And I thought, yes, you're like, yes, this is who I want to be. This is why they tell you, find somebody who has what you want and ask them how they got it. You know what I mean? I can't be 30 again. That would be nice. But but I can be that, maybe, if I work at it. And so I worked at it. And then, of course, the miracles start to happen, right? You know, things start to happen. And, you know, you start to lose weight. And you, like, you know, you meet people. And you start to stitch all those broken pieces of yourself back together. You can almost feel them being glued back together inside you. And you become somebody else. I remember a woman said to me really early on. And she said, you have no idea, thank you, what your life is about to be like. And I thought, yeah, of course, sure. But she was right. She was totally right. Because my life unfolded dramatically. I came here. I've always wanted to live in L.A. And I never was able to pull it off. And I thought, I'm finally going to move for the right reason. And I did. And I built my life over again at the age of 58. Who blows up their life at 58? And breathes? I mean, that's insane to do. But you can do it if you have faith. And what this program gave me was a faith that the bad days wouldn't last forever and that tomorrow would be better than today. That's what this 12 steps gave me. And I went through them like my life depended on it, because my life depended on it. That's the miracle. That's what I came to realize. It wasn't easy. The fourth and eighth and ninth, those are tough steps. Like, there's no joke. I say to my sponsees all the time now, like, this is a really simple program, but it is tough. And you have got to steel yourself to do it. You've got to want it. And I think that's why they talk about the gift of desperation all the time, right? Like, it is a gift. Because when you're that desperate, you'll just do anything. To me, the thought of giving up sugar, I was like, oh, how am I going to do this? My entire diet is based on sugar. Everything I eat has sugar in it. I just thought, and then, you know, Joey's my sponsor. He's like, well, okay, can you not eat sugar today? Like, that's why it's one day at a time. Like, you have to break it off, ironically, into bite-sized pieces. And then that's how it works. You know what I mean? That's how it works. And then you get time under your belt, and your life starts to unfold. And then the thing was, I thought, okay, now I'm stitching myself back together. I'm getting the payoff. HP is going to come down from the sky and give me the big love. And then I'm going to give the lead share. See, I'm getting married. It's amazing. Did not happen. I met a guy here 2 years ago. And I went on a bunch of bad days, but I met this guy, and I was like, you're the guy. Like, oh my God, you're the guy. Like, I finally found the guy. Like, he was like, yes. And then we were in a parking lot after seeing a movie, and then I said something about something, and he said, oh, I'd love to do that. Can we do it as friends? And I tell you, I stood there in that parking lot and I felt myself break in half. And I went home and I got into bed. And when I'm depressed, I don't turn any lights on. I live in the dark. It's in the dark. And I'm in the bed and I just said, and I kept saying over and over, how come I don't get a turn? Why is it never my turn? Why does everybody else get a turn and I don't get a turn? It's the closest I've ever come to leaving program. Because I just thought, why the fuck am I doing this? I've done all the work and all this and then sponsoring and meeting it. And I still don't get it. I'm still the six-year-old who doesn't get the love. Why? Why? Two-way prayer. Got the answer. The answer was because. Yeah. That's the answer. Guess what? It's not up to you to decide. I will tell you this. I met a fellow from London. We became really like close pen pals. He came to visit and we met in San Francisco and we took a walk and I was talking about the love thing and I was like, I just don't understand it. I'm trying to be on the path. I'm trying to trust the plan. I'm trying to trust my higher power and it just doesn't seem to be, you know. And then he turned to me and said, do you really? I said, well, I think I do. He's like, So we got to this clearing that overlooks the Golden Gate Bridge. I swear to God, it's true story. I still have the picture on my phone. We're on the Golden Gate Bridge, and my friend Matt, who's with me, he said, look down. And I looked down. We're at this big wooden railing, and carved into the railing is, trust the path. And I looked up, and I said, oh, my God, okay. Got it. So... will I ever find the real love? Like, look, my life is 3/4 over. Actuarially speaking, probably not. But man, I have a lot of love in my life. Thank you. And I'll wrap up and with this and say that sometimes we don't get what we want, we get what we need. And trusting that part, trusting the path, trusting the plan, that's the work. And if you can do that, if I can do that, then I'll have plenty of company in my emergency room of life. Thank you so much for letting me share. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous. God knows that's true. As a whole, when asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Julie.
How do you deal with bright siders? People are like, oh, yes, you're going to look at all you have.
I love that we're starting with such a cynical question. The question is, how do I deal with the bright siders, the people who are always like, oh, look at everything you have, it's great, you're awesome. yeah. Look, God bless them, right? I mean, their hearts are in the right place. But, yeah, I'm not always in the right frame of mind to hear that message. I would say actually most of the time I'm not in the frame of mind to hear that message. It's funny, when I was a boy, the one thing my mother was really good at was comfort. And I would get bullied or something, and she had a really powerful response that I'd never heard from anybody else. She would hug me, and I would cry or whatever, and then she'd say, I know. That was all she, like, and it was so amazing to be seen that way, you know, because people say, shh, you know, it'll be fine, but no, I know, right? And so I carry that with me when people are really, when the bright siders come in, I'm just like, you know what, they're doing their best, you know what I mean, their hearts are in the right place, and I try not to be a cynic about it, I try not to push back about it, I don't think that anything comes from that, you know, I think you have to be grateful, and gratitude is a big part of my program. You know, I do the list a lot of the things I do have, because, you know, it's a choice. It's a choice whether you're going to look at the world half empty and half full. And I think, you know, the half full or better people have something to teach us, you know. Eleanor.
Could you say a little bit more about your two-way prayer process?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so the question is about my two-way prayer process. So I started this early. I've always been, I was raised Catholic, and I was always one for two-way prayer, even as a kid. I would just talk to God and say, you know, what's up? Like, what do you think? You know, whatever. And then I would wait to hear something. I didn't always hear something, but it's gotten, I think my hearing has gotten better as I've been in program, I would say that. And like I said, I think I trust it so much because I just don't get the answers I want. I know what I want God to say, you know. I want God to say, no, you don't owe that person an amends. Or, nah, you don't have to do that. Or, yeah, it's okay if you have this to eat. But never says that. And so I just trust it's intuitive to me, and I am very grateful for it. And it is a lever I pull a lot. My prayer meditation practice, which is not organized, you know, these people who get up in the morning and they're like, oh, and then I do the readers, and then I do this, and then I put a stained glass window up in my kitchen. It's exhausting, and I'm like, no, I can't. So, but I try at least once a week. I sit on my bedroom floor, I light a candle, and I just start talking. And I just say, okay, here's where I'm at, and here's what I'm struggling with. And I ask for things, and I've gotten a little better, I will say, progress here, not perfection, of not asking for things for myself, you know what I mean? Like the love thing, you know, is like, I don't ask that anymore. I just started therapy, and because God said to me, you need a therapist. Which, again, not the answer I wanted, right? At all. And I made a New Year's resolution. I said, I'm going to find a therapist. And it took me 2 months because of my insurance nonsense. But I did. And I started 2 weeks ago. And I go in and I sit with this guy. And I made sure to not say to him, look, I want you to help me find love. I didn't say that. I said, I want you to help me be good with what I have. Whatever that looks like. I would like this, but I don't need that. I need you to help me live in gratitude and live a holistic life with what I have and not always be looking for what I don't. That's what I'm looking for. He took furious notes and then looked up at me and said, oh, you're going to be fun. But getting back to the two-way prayer thing, again, like that's what I'm asking for. When I do two-way prayer now, I just say, okay, I'm a mess about X or whatever. And then sometimes I'm not a mess, actually. Sometimes I'm pretty good. Sometimes I just say, all right, look, I don't have a lot to report here. Like, things are, I feel pretty good. Like, let's try to stick with this. Okay? Good? You good? I'm good. But I always get an answer. I feel like if you can sit in quiet, which is not easy for me all the time, to sit in quiet and not have your mind raised, that you'll get an answer. I've always gotten an answer. Always.
Thank you so much for your share. As an adult now, how do you not go back to a six-year-old boy who was looking for that validation always externally? How do you navigate that now?
Okay, great. The question was, how do I not go back to the six-year-old now that I'm an adult? I do go back to the six-year-old because he's in there, right? And sometimes he's really loud. And I think the mistake I made as an adult was ignoring him, was saying, you know what, you've had your day. And, yeah, it didn't always work out, but shut up. And he's the best part of me. He's the one I've got to keep alive. He's the one I was shoving food at and making sick in the process. But I think of him, there's a picture of me. My mother took an old Polaroid camera, and it was right before I started first grade, and I was so excited, and I had my book bag, and we're in our backyard, and I'm wearing this gold and awful gold and aqua shirt, and but it was like Star Trek, like that was, you know, that was the thing, and I lived in that shirt that summer, loved it. And I look at his face, and he's so expectant, right? He's going to go to school. I didn't go to kindergarten, because we were in Philly, and you just didn't do that. But like, I look at his face, and I have that picture, and I'm so glad I saved it, because that's the me I need to keep alive. You know? The me that was unspoiled by life then, who thought life was a big, big world. I was a dreamer from a young age, you know? I used to sit in my bedroom window, look out. We looked out at the driveway behind us. But in the way in the distance, you could see the buildings of a town. And I was like, this is a big world, and I'm going to go see it. And I did. I wasn't healthy for a lot of it. But that part of me, that sort of wondrous part of the six-year-old me, man, I hold him a lot closer now than I ever have. That's the truth.
Thank you so much for your share. Can you talk a little bit about how you sponsor people?
Yes, thank you. The question is, how do I sponsor people? I sponsor the way I've been sponsored. I think that probably happens a lot, right? You know, so I've been with my sponsor now since he's the same sponsor I've had since the beginning. So it'll be 4 years, hopefully, in August. And so I have two sponsees now. I think that's a good number for me. I've had more, but it doesn't always go well when I have too many people. So I have two people. And I am the gentle hard ass, which is what I think the right split is, which is like, if you're not going to do the work, then you're wasting my time. Because there are people who need sponsors. Especially men, you know what I mean? They're not as many of us as there are you. So I am like, so I just, I'll be there every step of the way, but it's not my job to work your program. Like, my sponsor was like, I'm not your mom. I'm not going to, like, no. You've got to want it. You've got to do it. And I'm not going to harangue you. But if you don't do it, then you can move on to somebody else. And he meant it, and I knew it. And so that's the way I sponsor. I'm just like, okay, you know, I want you to check in with me. We come to a mutual understanding how we're going to work it. You know, you're going to talk to me these days. You're going to do a 90 and 90. You're going to do the step work, and we're going to, you know, sit down, and we're going to read it together, and blah, blah, blah. And the one inviolate rule I have of sponsoring is you cannot lie to me. I don't care if you binged your head off last night. tell me, fine, I will not judge you at all. I will stick with you through every relapse. I will. I will not let you go. But you cannot lie to me about it. Because if you lie to me, then we have nothing. And so it's worked out. You know what I mean? I've had 4 sponsees to drop me for various reasons, because that happens. You know, it's not the right fit, or they leave the program. You know, they decide it's not for them. But I've had 2. I have one now on his 11th step, which is great. He's actually doing amazing. And then I have one who's on his 4th step. So, yeah. I mean, it's that balance, you know, that I think worked for me and hopefully is working for them.
Thank you so much for your share. How has your creative life, editing, writing, changed since getting into program?
Ah, how has my creative life changed since getting into program? It's funny. It's changed a lot. I used to do a lot of work that I didn't really want to do, but I did it because it was prestigious, or because it was in a magazine I wanted to be in, or, you know, they were going to put my picture on the contributors page, and it was a lot of vanity attached to all that. And now I generally do work that I want to do. I enjoy it, and I'm grateful that I get to do it. I mean, a lot of people have jobs, and I have had a career, which is different. And most people don't get to spend their lives doing what they love to do. They do things that pay for their houses. But I got to do something that did both. So I'm really, really grateful for that. Thank you. And, you know, my 3rd novel comes out next month. You know, who gets to do that? You know what I mean? Thank you. But, like, not a lot of people get to do that. You know what I mean? And I don't say that because I'm so special. I get it because I'm grateful. Because that was given to me. You know what I mean? And I am smart enough now and been in program long enough now to know that that was a gift and that one has to acknowledge one's gifts when they're given. But yeah, it's been great.
Thank you so much. That was the most amazing TED Talk I've ever heard. So with your... I guess can you talk more about when you started getting your recovery, also your physical recovery? Like how did you get there, and how are you still able to manage it?
Okay, so the question is, how was I able to achieve my physical recovery, and how am I able to maintain it?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, that desperation thing came in. I did what I guess a lot of people did. My original food plan with my sponsor was so restrictive. I was like, never eating another carbohydrate. And then I was 2 weeks in, I was like, okay, this feels like a diet. This feels like, you know, I'm on like Jenny Craig or something. And I was like, and I called him and I said, okay, look, I think I blew this. Like, I don't think this is going to work. And he was like, good for you. Like, okay, let's figure it out. So he said, all right, we figured it out. We modified it. But again, this is the honesty thing, right? I would never have made that decision on my own. Ever. Like, I knew enough to know I cannot see this clearly. Somebody's got to call the balls and strikes. And so he was like, all right, this is what I think you should try. And then call me. And, like, it was a constant. It took a while. It took me a couple months to figure out the food thing. Because I only knew restricting and binging. I didn't know what the middle looked like. And to me, the middle felt like cheating. Because I was like, well, I'm allowed to have bread? This just feels like naughty. But no, I eat bread. I eat bread. Like, I eat bread today. But there's things I can't eat. I can't eat refined sugar. Like, it will kill me. So I just don't eat it. And when I had the physical recovery, and then, which is the best, right? Because then you start shopping in your closet. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, I remember these pants. And, you know, it's amazing. And then you want to maintain it, right? Because you're like, well, now this is the new me. This is the me I want to keep. And there's, you know, and vanity plays a part in it. I just think... I didn't have an interest in fat serenity. I just didn't. You know what I mean? I don't judge anybody. And everybody struggles differently and everybody looks differently. It's fine. But, like, I just thought the physical part is part of my recovery. It's not the main part, frankly. I mean, the spiritual part is certainly the main part. And I get that. And I certainly buy into that. But when I am tempted, which is not often, I will say, to, you know, like the story I told about the, like, you know, the garage. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to screw it. Like, I'm going to do it. I have such a vivid memory of what life was like in the food. Like, right before I came into program in that summer of 2020. I can picture it like a movie unspooling in my head. It is in Technicolor. And I just think, we cannot go back there. Like, we cannot. And if I have one bite of a cupcake, one, like, it's over. Like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to be calling my sponsor saying, oh, Joe, I'm an ice cream cone. Like, I'm going to call Joe and say, okay, this is my fourth gallon of ice cream that I'm now eating. That's what's going to happen. And I know it. I know it. And I have a higher power that says, yeah, you're right. Two-way. And so I, you know, I think that keeps me on the straight and narrow. Because even on the tough days, and look, we all have tough days in this program. It's not a panacea, right? The program is not here to tell you life's going to be great. The program is here to say, when life isn't great, we'll get you through it without killing yourself with this food. That's what it is. And so I'll take that, you know? It's enough. It's more than most people get. And that's enough to keep me going. I guess that's it. Thank you. Okay.